Northfield.
Connect and experience art at the Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our galleries, arts festival, and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning. This is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, radio for the imagination. Thanks so much for listening to the show that celebrates creating and stories. And I'm so excited to have you here today. We're going to celebrate, of course, and we're going to tune our imaginations together. But first, I'm going to tell you about my day yesterday, just a little slice of it. I had one of those days yesterday, and it seemed that at every corner I turned, there was another something that I didn't want to deal with at that moment. After school, my son left the milk bottle out and a cereal bowl with a ring of milk in the bottom. The cat, of course, somehow knew this and came from her day-long nap upstairs and found the bowl. And this makes me so mad because I know there will be a mess later because she never learns that drinking milk does not agree with her digestive system. So when I heard the little, quick little kitty tongue licking the bowl, I dashed into the kitchen only to have her jump off the counter and run to the back hallway, where of course my son had left the back door open to the garage. What was he thinking? Anyway, so I got that all settled. We come to dinner time, and at dinner, one of the things we made was we experimented with a new garlic butter spread. So I was eating a piece of garlic with dinner, garlic bread, kind of testing it out, and I was mulling the flavors of this new garlic spread. I took my first bite, pondering it and talking about the texture, and then I felt something hard in my mouth, and I was like, what is that? There's a stone. No, it wasn't a stone. It was my tooth. Great news. This wasn't the tooth that the dentist had on a watch. It's another tooth. So, yay me, I get to have two crowns. And of course, ridiculous things happened. Like when I went to go get the dinner ready, get the cheese and the sausage and the ricotta out of the refrigerator, the big meat and cheese tray fell off the rails. And I was caught there holding this heavy, wide drawer trying to get it back on the track so it would slide. It was like an aerobics workout. I would get one side working and then the other side would be off. The drawer wouldn't go in, and so the big door in the refrigerator wouldn't close. And it started beeping, and I couldn't make it work, and it was so annoying, the beep would not stop. And I'm embarrassed to say how long I fought with this drawer. It was, I don't know, I spent just a really long time pushing and prodding and pondering it. And let's just say that the light went off in the refrigerator, which I didn't know there was like a thing. If it stays on too long, it goes off eventually, probably to protect it. And then the temperature went up 10 degrees. It was a long time. By the end, my back was sore from trying to will the drawer back into its spot, and my throat felt scratchy from trying to command, let's say, the door to work. Well, finally, my daughter came home from practice, and she helped to hold the drawer so we could get under there and look at the tracks and figure out how the rails worked, and together we got it to get it back into place. So it was one of those days. That's just a few of the things. Like every day seems to be for me. And I feel like that's the story of my life. So please tell me that's your life too. Here's the way my mind works. So as these things are happening to me, I'm thinking, I wonder if I could make this into a poem or add this to a scene in one of my story chapters. That's what keeps me going through these moments. What's the shape of this experience? What are the sensory details that I should note? What emotions are stirred? What would I compare this experience to? And what does this experience illuminate? It's silly, but that's how my mind works, and that's how I process life, trying to make sense of my world through making a something, a piece of writing, a piece of art, a shared experience. So let's get together, share a story or a poem, and today we're going to do that. We're going to talk with two fantastic poets and hear how they make sense of life through their poems. Today in the Art Zany Radio studio, I welcome poets Becky Bowling, whose new book is Here Beyond Small Wonders, and Susan Jarrett McKinstry, whose book Tumble Home is also new, to preview their upcoming event at Content Bookstore. I hope you'll come with me to celebrate National Poetry Month, discover the joy, the wonder, glory, and wisdom of poetry. Their event is at Content Bookstore Poetry Night on Thursday, May 15th. So we're giving you plenty of advance notice to get that on your calendar. It's at 7 p.m., but we wanted to celebrate Poetry Month with you all. So please come join them. We'll talk about these books, and I'll give you some more details as we go through the show. But I wanted to turn on their mics and get them into the show so we can talk about all things poetry, which is one of the fun things that I love to do. So tell me, let's start just with quick introductions, a little bit about yourselves. I've got these long introductions, but I thought that I'll post on the website, but I thought it'd be fun to hear from you a little bit about yourselves and your poetry world. Susan, do you want to start?
Sure. Hi, I'm so glad to be here. I retired from Carleton College less than a month ago, so...
Oh, it's very, very new.
This is all very new to me in terms of having time to focus on poetry, but I've been writing as long as I remember, and this is indeed my first book. It's a little chapbook that came out in October, and I love your description of trying to shape events and experiences into something and sort of make sense out of what otherwise doesn't make sense or begins to feel like just a barrage of experiences. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, thank you. It's such a delight to have you here. And we'll talk a little bit about your poetry writing over the years, which is something you've done for a long time. And Becky, welcome back to Art Zany Radio.
Thank you. It's always fun to be here.
Yeah, I love having you here, too. And we're going to... I wonder if I got the wrong mic. That might be my... I'll try again. It is 3. I got the wrong one. Let's try that again. So tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your poetry world, which hopefully people in this town know, because you were co-polo, as we like to say, co-laureate with your husband, Doug Green, and you've been involved in a lot of the different poetry events, but maybe folks don't know a little bit about yourself as a poet.
Well, that's wonderful to know that you're so aware of what I've been doing and so on. Sometimes I don't think I'm so aware of what I'm doing. But I have come to poetry later than some people. Not that I didn't dabble in it on occasion, but I was mostly writing in prose and academic articles because I was teaching at Carleton College. So I retired a little bit longer ago than Susan. Susan and I are colleagues from Carleton, of course. And this is also my first book, Here Beyond Small Wonders. And my husband has been writing poetry, though, forever, like Susan. And it was impossible for me not to be competitive with him. So he would sit down to write his poem, and I would sit down to write my poem.
I didn't realize there was a competition between you two. Friendly, of course.
Friendly, yes. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but I sort of thought, here I have this source, and I'm going to use him.
Yeah, and you did, and it's so delightful to see this book come to life, and I'm sure you're both very excited to, you know, put it out in the world. I wonder, one of the questions I wanted to start with was, when did you start writing poetry, and then when did you first call yourself a poet, or add it to your bio, or introduce yourself to somebody as a poet? I don't know which one of you wants to grab that first.
Well, I can go quickly. Since I came to it late, one of the major ways that I found myself being nurtured by the poetic community was through the sidewalk poetry contests. I didn't expect to have any poems on the sidewalk, but I eventually ended up with 2, I believe. And that was such a great experience. And I remember that Bonnie Flom one time at a reading to celebrate that year's Sidewalk Poems, she gave me a sticker that said, Becky Bowling, poet.
Oh.
And I thought, I guess I'm a poet. So I took that sticker and put it on a book that I had so that I could always see it. And that's how I feel like I became a poet.
Oh, that's such a great story. We, cheers to Bonnie. She did so much great work for our community, and that's really lovely. Yeah, she was a champion of that program and did amazing things. I had the opportunity to have many of those folks in the studio, and it was just a thrill each time to hear. It's a pretty unique feature of our community to have that. How about for you, Susan? When was it that you know, being in academia and teaching in the English department?
My poetry was always completely separate from my career, which I think is pretty interesting. But I was writing as a little kid. I had two older brothers, very talkative, very outgoing. And so they would talk all the time, and I would just write. I secretly write little poems down, and I can still remember some of them.
Were you observing them and translating?
I was observing them, yeah. And I was just enthralled by them because they saw the world differently than I did, but I was also so close to them, so that it was this fascinating way of trying to sort of channel that experience and reflect it. And then at Carleton, I was an academic, was told when I came here not to put poetry on my resume because that made you look not serious as a scholar. Again, I've talked about this. So then I I kept writing quietly. Some of it is published under a different name, which was very convenient. And then I suddenly began to teach poetry because we hired someone who then had to leave, and so we had an advanced poetry course that needed to be taught. And I taught a lot of poetry in my theory courses. So I taught that course and found it really fun. So then I began to teach a creative writing class every year. That was probably 20 years ago, maybe. And I also taught creative nonfiction every year. So I am one of the creative writing teachers at Carleton, but I don't know if I thought of myself as a poet. I wanted to think of myself as a poet. And so there was actually a point where I said, Susan, if you want to be a poet, you have to have a book. So that's partly why I put this book together. I thought, well, okay, let's find out if you're a poet or not.
Oh, interesting.
So it was really fun to put the book together for that reason.
I think, yeah, that is fascinating. And we have to say that I was at your event that you had up at Carleton, and I don't know how many people. It was a huge room, and it was packed. There were people standing. There had to be a couple hundred people.
Yeah.
That's at least, I mean, I don't know if you ever counted, but I thought, I love this town. Yeah. We have 200 people plus. It could have been 300. I don't know. It was jam-packed to show up for a poetry event.
It was so, that was so much fun, and it reminded me of why poetry is such a kind of magical object, because it's small and it's musical. I mean, novels are wonderful, but hearing part of a novel read out loud, you just feel like you've gotten a tiny bite of something. But with a poem, you've got the whole morsel in your mouth, and you can sort of taste it. So it just felt like a perfect example of why poetry works.
Oh, yeah, that's such a great thing. In your teaching, was poetry, Becky, in Spanish you taught, and other departments as well. I'd love to hear how the students thought of poetry when you were teaching.
Well, poetry wasn't actually my field, so when I included poetry, it was normally in the courses of a general theme where the poems would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
Were women's studies, for example, gender studies, we would often read women poets from Latin America, and the students responded very well to them. Whenever I gave students the option of a creative, expressive project, poetry was one of the ways they would shift. They would go to poems, and images, visual images, were quite useful to the to the students to get at things that they thought were important to them.
It's pretty accessible in that same way, you know, to if you're learning Spanish, or even if you're an advanced Spanish student, to read a novel, and that's really hard, but you can enter a poem in a way that you can't with a longer piece. And so I loved poetry for that reason. It's always fun to read, especially if you can get a hold of a copy that has Spanish and English, and then you trust the translator, which is always a question. But that's exciting. And then for you, Susan, tell me, does Carleton still have like journals that they publish of student work, and are students fascinated by poetry in the English department?
You know, my simple answer is yes, they are. And there are student-run publications, which are extraordinary and just ongoing. There are student groups that meet to work on one another's writing regularly. I love that they've done that on their own, that it's outside of the coursework. You can get a creative writing minor at Carleton through the English department, so
that's
it
exciting.
Can be official that way, but it's a very loose, I mean, you have to take creative writing courses, but aside from that, the students do all sorts of really inventive stuff, which I love. And I always taught poetry in all different classes. It's great for theory because it's such a short, accessible object, so you can look at a poem and then you can understand feminist theory or deconstruction or whatever it is you're trying to understand. And I also really loved teaching the creative writing class, in which I taught prose and poetry and creative nonfiction. And it began with prose. Students were comfortable. Middle section was creative nonfiction. They were comfortable. And then we shifted to poetry, and some of them were like, oh, I don't like poetry. Yep. Oh, I don't understand poetry. And then they would sort of fall in love with it.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite student was a complete STEM student, a math lover, just a really fantastic brain, really organized. And he understood that in poetry, you just paid really close attention to things. You were really observant. And he wrote a Fibonacci series poem. I'm not even sure I pronounced that exactly right.
I think so.
It was this amazing moment where what he knew and what poetry could allow came together, and it was, I mean, it was breath. You could tell I'm breathless.
Yeah, I can tell, yeah.
So it was really great. So, I don't think they always come thinking they love poetry, but often you can win them over. And the last thing, the last thing I'll say is you can win them over by helping them remember that the songs they love are poems. Because I was a singer-songwriter all the way through college, and I sometimes think if they forget that and they think of poetry as this cold thing that, you know, was long dead and that there's a right answer to, that's a problem. But if they think of it as the songs that they're humming in their heads and listening to in their ears, all of a sudden it comes to life.
So that's such a brilliant way to show people that, you know, and there's not a kid now that doesn't walk around with, you know, something on their head with listening to songs and music. And so I don't know how we can make them listen to poetry when as an option too. We'll have to ponder that. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And so let's talk about each of your poetry. And, you know, how do you find the subjects for your poems? How do you know that something's going to turn into a poem, or that an idea or a word or a thought is going to, you know, work its way through your mind and come out as a poem? Let's start with you, Becky.
I think of myself as an intuitive poet. So I am not drawn to writing in standard forms, although I've started to experiment more and more mm-hmm. with certain poems. The death of Pope Francis, for example, that morning I sat down and I wrote several nonnets to him, which is 9 syllables, 8, 7, 6, 4, 5, 3, 2, 1. And one of the challenges of that form is you cannot end on a weak word.
Yes.
You must find some way to slender down your thought into a word that's going to have a punch. So that's one of the forms that I like a lot. There are several other smaller forms that I like. My husband loves some of the longer repetitive ones like villanelles.
Yeah.
And I forgot the name of the other one, but anyway.
I can hear him. He's telling us right now.
Yes, he's probably listening. And he knows how I feel about that. But I'm not given to practicing that kind. I hear a phrase in my head, and that sometimes is the first line of a poem. Or I see something that is a story, a very little story that doesn't really need a prose story format. It needs a moment. It's a flash. Well, it could be a flash fiction, actually. But sometimes those little moments I think of as deserving to be recorded in some way. And the language, the best situation I have is when the language just flows. But I think people feel that way about all writing. If it flows, that's an extremely satisfying feeling versus struggling. Oh, how am I going to say this? How am I going to segue to that? But I like to be descriptive, and I like small things. That's why this is Small Wonders. And the natural world is always a source of inspiration. We often go to Mexico, my husband and I, and we also visit friends on Lake Michigan. And those are places that just inspire me to know to no end. Mm-hmm. So it's moments like that, incandescent experiences, that I like to work with. And I love the sound of words. And I like being somewhat frivolous or humorous on occasion, too, and not always, I don't want to be morose. But nostalgia and other tones are something that draws me. My mother's death, her experience in her last years, I wrote a lot of poems about that, which was extremely good personal therapy. So almost anything can become a poem, though. If you look at something long enough and listen, then I think it comes.
I think if folks are listening, she gave you a lot of different entry points to become, you can experiment with poetry and experiment with words. You can use structure. You can use free verse. You can use what's in front of you, just any topic. But it's the listening and the sort of, keep working at it. You can't, rarely do I know anyone who's just had a flash and then boom, it's on the page and voila. It takes a while to work it and to, sift it around and sort through it and get, like you said, I think the endings of poems are the most important, because if you don't end with something that makes somebody have a moment and just a connection, then I don't think it holds. That's at least my experience. Yeah, so how about for you, Susan? Where are you finding your poems and what?
I love that. I would agree with everything Becky said.
Yeah.
I'll just add, I think like a lot of poets in Northfield and around the world, I write a poem a day in April.
Mm-hmm.
And did that in October as well, the year that I wrote the little book. And it always begins with this, like, day one, I've got to write a poem. My first one year was about the number one. Just kind of looking for things, and I read the newspaper. Mm. Before I write anything, and I walk my dog, and so I'm reading the poems in the sidewalk, and I'm looking at things, and I just realize it's like I go through this little space of collecting ideas, but also sort of loosening up my brain, and then I sit down and I start writing and see what happens, and it's pretty magical, because when it turns into a poem right away, that's utterly fantastic. When it doesn't, I still begin to understand something that's puzzling me.
Because mm-hmm.
I'm not really interested in writing about what I understand. I'm interested in writing about what I can't figure out yet.
That's such a good point.
Right? So that's part of the fun of it. And then when I draft something, I just read it aloud over and over and over again. And then I begin to pull in more of the music and like really think about how it sounds. And that's really fun. I spend a lot of time with the thesaurus sometimes thinking, what's another word that will sort of capture the spark of that moment rather than the glimmer of that moment, which is soft, or, just thinking about the way it sounds as well as what it means. So for me, there's this process that Becky was describing too, and just inside that process, I am like 100% in that moment. And the rest of our lives, we're not 100% in a lot of the time. We're thinking about a million things and we're doing a million things. And that's a period of time where that's what I'm doing. That's it. The dog can't bother me. The cat can't bother me. The bird can't call me from downstairs. I'm writing.
I just wanted to say that intensity is one of the aspects that I love about it. And especially during troubled times, such as the times that we're going through right now. I don't write always to a political point, but I have done some poetry that responds to the crises that we're experiencing. I would also like to mention that reading other poets, I can't tell you how many times I've been stymied by people who say, I write novels, but I don't really like to read. Or, I like poetry, but I don't read other poets. And Doug is always reading other poets. And we share books. And when he finishes one, sometimes I'll pick it up and finish it. And then we put it in a special place that's done. And then, or I'll start a book of poems and pass it on to him. And then we discuss them sometimes to have favorite ones. I'll copy. That's another thing. Writing somebody else's poem is one way to understand it. Mm-hmm. In a way that just reading it to yourself or even out loud sometimes isn't sufficient, but when you take the time to write it out, you start looking at each and every word, and it has an impact. Memorizing somebody else's poems is a fantastic way to enter that world, and it can often spark as a sidebar. You will take a line. So a lot of poets will write blah, blah, blah is the title, and then after, Joyce Sutphin.
Oh, sure.
And this is one of the things that I find exhilarating, to find some kernel in somebody else's vision and then relating it to my own experience.
I think that's fascinating, because I haven't heard about the taking and handwriting what someone has, because I bet that's different than typing it in, or, you know, the way, and you learn about line breaks, and, you know, you have to pay attention to, you know, do they have a comma here, no comma, what are the capitalizations, you know, you kind of get into the structure of the poem, or almost into the heart of the poem, too, that you might not get from just looking at it. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I wanted to talk with both of you about, is reading poetry, but also reading poetry aloud, and how that is a part of your practice, and what that can help you with, or just how you take a book of poetry and read somebody else's work. Are you starting from beginning to end? Can you just randomly, you know, jump in and grab a poem? And, you know, what are the ways that you take a look at reading poetry?
I tend to, if I get a book, I tend to start at the beginning and read it all the way through, because I know that a poet has thought hard about how to put the poems together in that book. Although I think one of my favorite moments with Tumble Home is people who've written to me and said, I started with poem X on page 35. You know, the title just caught my attention. And I think that's fantastic. You know, it doesn't have to be done in any order. So I have two different ways. One is the kind of immersion into somebody's book. I'm still working through a Jory Graham book, which I think I may be working on for the rest of my life, because it's so dense. I can do like one a day and think, wait, I have to start again. But other than that, I have two poem a day kinds of things that I get in my inbox.
Oh,
so
sure.
Sort of, I'll call them random. They're of course not random. They're carefully picked, but very different kinds of poems.
You didn't pick.
I did not pick.
So you might be introduced to a new...
Right. I'm always introduced to new poets, and I often read those out loud, because, as Becky said, it's partly that they put things so differently than I would. The phrasing is different.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even reading it out loud, I realize I almost stumble over the syntax, because it's deliberately sort of an obstacle to kind of straightforward transparency. So I can't imagine being a poet and not reading other poets. Like,
yeah.
Why would you do that?
Well, and I when I'm listening to somebody read a poem and they want feedback on it, I always read with a pen, because oftentimes they will sometimes add a word or change a word, and I note it for them. Which one is it that you intended? Because sometimes the subconscious is doing something. Maybe it's just a flub. Maybe it's just an error. But it sometimes points out to them, this is another way of saying it, and maybe I should look at that. And so I think that's a way to you know, work on your poems, too. Did you have some more you wanted to add about reading poetry or reading others' work?
It never occurred to me to just open a poetry book randomly, because it suggests then that they're all in there as separate items.
Ah.
And I like the way they speak to one another. And Doug and I want to do a book together, and about our relationship and marriage and so on, because we find that sometimes we write poems in a parallel way, almost as call and response. I totally agree with Susan that the structure of a poetry book, we've put one together. I've actually put so many books together that have gone nowhere. They're on my machine. But anyway, you have to have an arc. that you're using some kind of, you want a good couple of poems at the beginning, because sometimes the reviewers only read the first couple of poems. Some of them will read the first couple and the last and one in the middle maybe. So those are kind of hot spots in your book, and then you want it to sort of be, well, why? Why did she put it all together in one format? So a book is different from publishing a poem in a journal. So I find it hard, but there are books that I think I want to go back to read poetry. And I think in that case, I would just open it up in the middle. Because there's something lovely about random or serendipity that, oh, I landed on this. If you don't read astrology, maybe this is your alternative. Read a poem at random and let it tell you what the day is going to be like.
Ooh, I love that idea. That's such a good one. Folks, if you're just tuning in, this is Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. I'm Paula Granquist here with Becky Bowling and Susan Jarrett McKinstry. We're talking about their new books of poetry. Here Beyond Small Wonder is by Becky Bowling, and Tumble Home by Susan Jarrett McKinstry. And I think the first time I probably saw both of you as poets was at one of those open mic readings, I bet. And the Northfield has a wonderful tradition of having an incredible community. I want to remind people that the Northfield Poet Laureate still sponsors a Northfield POME, they call it, a poetry open mic event at the Northfield Public Library atrium the second Wednesday of each month. Everyone is invited to read a poem of their own or read a, it's 6:30, yes, and read a poem of their own or read a something from one of their favorite poets. And it's a lovely collection of poetry and people that, that come to those events. I've enjoyed them. So I just really got to see your work as it was developing and you were reading new things. So I think now would be a great time for us to have our listeners hear a little bit of your poetry from these new collections. I don't know if you both selected or have something in mind that you'd like to read. We'll start with Susan then.
Yeah, because part of what I love, I just got Becky's book myself not too long ago. They're very different, these two books. And so mine is very much of a narrative. And I'll just introduce really quickly. It was all written, all but two poems were written in the fall of 22 when I took an alumni, a Carleton alumni trip to the west coast of Ireland with an Irish geoarchaeologist. So we were in these beautiful landscapes with these incredible ancient monuments, kind of a mysterious place and fascinating place. And there was a lot going on in my personal life at the same time. Then I came back and I had the term off because I'd been gone during part of the term. And I revised those poems and then wrote another poem every day during that October, revised them all, sent them out in January, and the book was accepted. And then it took like, you know, a year and a half to be published. So it took forever, but it was, it's very compressed and it absolutely is like a fairy tale quest. So, I'll read the first poem. It's got three sections called, the first one is called Leaving Coins. So I'll read the poem Leaving Coins because that sets up the poem and the book. She hands me a small tin of coins, asks if I will leave them along my overseas travels in memory of her father. I never knew him. I only know his suicide shadows her heart. I do not ask enough questions about the task, her hopes. Like a foolish character in a fairy tale or quest, I simply set out, tin in hand. The west coast of Ireland holds history, religion, myth in each rocky hillside, deep pool, and cloud-shaded lake. Fairy gifts and sacred objects festoon small trees. Virgins, angels, bells, COVID masks hang together to mark centuries of belief and hope. In a great stone circle on an improvised altar of small offerings, I leave one coin. The Valley of Madness, the monastery of exile, the monk's fishing house cleverly built over a rushing river to feed the abbey, the portal tomb pointing upward in a vast field of limestone slabs, each proof of human yearning to grasp something beyond limited life, coins for all. When the tin was empty, I came home, quest done, trying to explain in words and iPhone photos what each place meant and felt. I understood grand attempts. Each giant stone laid atop another says as much about faith as engineering. Those ancient sites chastise our casual cries and highlight our small, essential gestures. The quest is always more about what the quester learns than what the task asks. My brother's ashes drift about the world's seas. Grief is always precise and dispersed. Coins glint from a rock, quiet lake, flashing stream, tangled garden, crashing sea, a trail of tiny crumbs to follow, a small bright bit of human memory offered to the magnificent, indifferent world that goes on regardless.
I love that poem. I think that, and it's so great to have you read it to us. There's something incredible about that request that you received, and then, you know, how you process that, and then, you know, that shapes the entire book. And was it an expected request or just kind of a random?
No, I mean, this is my friend Leslie Schultz, the poet Leslie Schultz.
Oh, I adore Leslie.
Leslie has been doing this for years.
I didn't know this.
I didn't really expect it. I mean, so I did literally have this little tin of coins, and I kept thinking, this is a big responsibility.
Yes, right.
So it shaped my experience of each of those places, too, to think, what can I put? And it was this period of time. The Irish do put objects in trees for fairy offerings or safe offerings or whatever.
Yeah, it coincided with your place of visiting, and then you got to, like, I think, look at the places a little differently because you were seeking out those spaces and examining them, right?
So I was a participant and maker as well as an observer. It was a pretty amazing experience.
Oh, I'm so glad I got to learn a little bit more about that. That's incredible. Do you want to read another one, or do we want to go over to Becky? What do you think?
Sure.
And actually, at some point, if people pick up the books, I was thinking it might be fun just for them to, that if you were to take that poem that we just heard from Susan, and then read it also with the one in Becky's book, Here Beyond Small Wonders, Drowned, for Marie.
Can I do that?
I feel like that's like a conversation.
Let's do it.
It's an interesting. This one is also very beautiful, but wow, it really got to me. But it's a different way of thinking about that same topic of.
Okay.
Oh, here, let me grab get your mic set. There you go.
Okay. Yes, of course. I'd love to read this poem. This is one that I wrote for Marie Barone, who's actually a pen pal of mine in Ohio, and we share creative projects together. She's more in the visual realm, and I'm more in the use of words. So, Drowned, for Marie. The drowned belong to the lake where they died. They slumber weightless on a bed of silt, fanned by ferns, kissed by shoals of limpid fish. They need no words nor breath, yet sometimes sigh. They hear children splash in the shallows, the whir of hungry dragonflies in flight, frogs on lily pads croaking for lost ones. When dappled ripples reflect the moon's crest, they hear a lone loon's tremolo far away, the cry of an owl's prey from the forest. The drowned belong to the lake where they died, forget that once they were fished from the deep, bewitched by the lake's liquid lullaby, rocked in cool, soothing arms that promised sleep.
That's so beautiful. And it's just such, and it's a lovely thing talking about, you know, death and the place of, you know, so those coins and the place that they land, and, you know, the place that these, you know, the drowned belong to the lake where they died, really struck me. Go ahead.
This was one that started the first line. The first line came to me, and it was an idea in that verse that I thought, I like that, I want to explore that.
Yeah, and it hits me, I won't go into it, but maybe after the show we can talk about the of an experience. And so I love when poetry can take you back to a time and take you back to, it gave me comfort you know, just like those coins did, thinking of what you can do if you've had this experience that's hard and difficult, and to make it something grander and bigger, and or to delve into it, to understand it a little bit more, come to some peace. So it's just really, it's beautiful. I love the way these poems did, that talk to each other, I think, in a way. So let's hear another from Becky.
Okay.
I'll let you pick.
Okay, thank you. I love it, though, when you suggest something. That's really fun, because I don't know if you realize how difficult it is.
Well, they're all your little, you know, babies, right? All your little, you know, things you've been working on for years, and, you know, you've collected them, selected them, structured the book, like you said, so to pick one randomly kind of takes away from that arc, and so it you know, it's a fascinating process.
I'll read one of the ones that is one of the older poems that I included in here, but I sort of like, in comparison or in contrast with Drowned, this has a totally different tone. Garden of Benign Neglect. And this one started because that phrase came to mind, and then Doug and I argued over whose phrase, who said that, meaning that he thought it was his phrase and I thought it was my phrase, so I wrote the poem real quick so I could own it. Garden of Benign Neglect. We bought a garden that came with a house. We bought it in summer when rose bushes bloomed. Robins and sparrows gathered at feeders, waded through rainbow pools in terracotta basins. The elm hovered above house and yard, gathered us like errant chicks under its bower, ferried squirrels from canopy to canopy, sifted sunshine and raindrops over us all. But we had no talent at green things, no patience with suet and sunflower seeds. We pulled out sprouting clumps of green, assuming they were weeds. We showered our yard with haphazard love and awkward attention. Like unreliable parents, we gave too little too late. We still have the house, but the garden has retreated, giving way to the hardier, more common grass-like growths. Birds fly by on their way to more hospitable dwellings. Our diseased elm was euthanized, its remains long ago carted off. We don't know the names of what's left. They come and go as they please. Fortunate, they have no need of us.
I can relate to that. We all have good intentions with gardens, and it's amazing when you do see. That's why I like the garden tour so much in Northfield, because there are people who have that ability. And so it makes it really relatable. I bet there's a lot of people that have come to you and said, oh, I get that. So now, do you own that phrase, the benign, what was it? I forgot now.
Garden of Benign Neglect.
Yes
I do.
Yeah, and it just shows. And I think as I was listening, I was thinking of the vocabulary that, you know, the way that you selected the word for the squirrels as they moved, and
ferried. You know, the tree ferried the squirrels.
Yes, right. And the you know, the elm tree having its demise. But so it's just lovely to see somebody who's got the right word. You worked hard to bring that to that moment and teach us, and but it's also very accessible and something we can all relate to. It's delightful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan, is there another from your book, Tumble Home? That was, I should mention, Becky Bowling's Here Beyond Small Wonders, and they will be at Content Bookstore. We want to give a shout out for that. If you want to hear more, on the 15th of May, that's a Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m., that's for a poetry night, and they'll both be reading and talking about all things poetry. I hope you'll come and join us for that night at Content Bookstore here in Northfield. They are at Content Bookstore. Oh, I forgot the website. Isn't that terrible? I usually write it down. Contentbookstore.com. Easy to remember. All one word. So join us there. But is there another that you're thinking of from your collection that might make sense to share?
I just want to say, listening to Becky's, I've been thinking a lot about why Minnesotans write so much poetry and why Northfielders write so much poetry. And I feel like it's because we look at something and 10 minutes later it's changed. It's gone. Like today it's cold and rainy and dreary, but a couple of days ago it felt like summer was almost here. And so we become really attentive to the details. So I love that poem because it's attentive to the immediate details as well as what's happening over a longer time. So,
and here I thought you were going to say, why do Minnesotans write so many poems about squirrels? We love squirrels.
Those darn rabbits.
I don't know. Rabbits. They show up too. Yeah.
Or the white squirrels.
Or the geese, yes.
There were three of them living in my yard for a period of time. It was quite remarkable. It was a
how rare.
White, yes, unfortunately, they're all gone at this moment, but I think some more will come back.
Oh, I hope so.
Anyway, yeah, I'd never heard of such a thing. And then there they were in Minnesota. So one of my early poems is on this white squirrel in Northfield.
I and black know. Squirrels, too, which are another thing. If you go up north, you can see them.
Yeah.
So we digress. Let's hear it with some another poem.
I'll read the last poem in the collection because the collection goes from the west coast of Ireland to the city of Galway for the center section, which is called Tumblehome. And then the final section comes back to Northfield, where I thought hard about, like, how to find my everyday life interesting after I'd been seeing all of these remarkable, unusual things. And then I was just back to, you know, back to what seemed kind of familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last section sort of works that through. So I'll read the last poem, which is called Return Again. Go back to the place where rounded hills rise, deep greens and rocky peaks beaded with soft white sheep, where dry limestone walls stitch the landscape into erratic patchwork edged by endless gray-blue seas, where you feel at once at home, though you never lived here. Stand on a high point at the end of a single-lane twister of narrow heart-stop road edging up the sharp mountain, stand wind-blasted and heart-spun, and read an Irish poem aloud, words rushing into the rain-bright air. Gulls' cries and wind's song, scattered words and distant cars, aching sound shards of yearning, disperse into the embracing landscape, curving around and away. You can always come back. You can never leave. Close your eyes wherever you are. May these set down words, held in place in a white space, carry you, heart hopeful, and heart warn you, home.
Oh, that is lovely. And it does, I think that's a very common feeling, right? It's, you know, how do you see your own world as glorious as you do on your travels? And there is something that, you know, happens because probably you get home and you have to get the mail and then there's
right.
bills and you have to fill the fridge.
And feed the pets.
And suddenly there's all those things that you are away from. But it can have its own rhythm.
Yeah.
It can have its own, you know, magnificence if you see it.
Mm-hmm.
So what a great arc that has. I think that's a really lovely...
It was really fun to create that.
Yeah, and I felt like, too, Becky, with yours, that there's almost the seasonal arc, right? You go through just, you know, and it felt so gradual that I wasn't like suddenly, ooh, oh, we're in, you know, spring. Like you really get some of those in between seasons too, which is a fun treat to read about. And to, there was one about the, was it the walnut tree that was going to shed its, was that the right tree that was going to shed its leaves? And you
it's mutiny.
Yes.
It's mutiny of the walnut trees.
And you're like, stop, no.
Yeah.
So you captured that so lovely.
Oh, thank you. But it was one of the things, and that's observation. When you're sitting, we were sitting on the back porch and we have a beautiful stand of walnuts that go east to west or west to east. And I noticed very early that all of a sudden there would be a yellow leaf in August. And I'm from southern Indiana. In August, you are dying from the humidity and the heat. It is the dead of summer. So I was really peeved.
And you turned that into a beautiful poem. There's lots more of these poems that will be shared at the event. You can get the books ahead of time. They are available at Content right now. We've got a couple other events that Becky wanted to mention as well that you both have coming up. One of those is at the Red Wing Depot. That's on Sunday, May 18th. Both Becky and Susan will be there. It's a part of the Red Wing Poet-Artist Collaboration, which always is is a fun experience to respond to visual work in a poetry, and it's fun for the artist to see what you highlight and to have that collaboration. So that's a delightful. That's on Sunday, May 18th from 1 to 3 down at the Red Wing Depot, another beautiful place to visit. And then on Tuesday, May 20th, Becky will be with a group of other artists and writers in the Readings by Writers, hosted by Tim Nolan. Peter Guy, our dear friend here in Northfield, he was just on last week on Art Zany Radio and had an event, a content that was, again, a packed event. I love that Northfield supports their writers. Brian Duran is going to be there, as well as Cass Douglas. And so you can get that information at the University Club, although not on the website.
St. Paul.
Yes, it's up in St. Paul. If you look up Tim Nolan, I think you can find the
7:30.
Yes, the information about the event, Tuesday, May 20th at 7:30. And then Becky's got an event at the Books on Central in Faribault on Thursday, May 22nd at 6. So lots of chances to hear your words and your poetry. Gosh, I do have more questions than we have time for, because I love diving into this. So maybe we can just talk about just what is great about having a book out in the world.
Well, I like what Susan was saying about feeling in some ways maybe compulsion is too strong a word, but that you want to get... the first time I was published anywhere... with my creative work that wasn't self-published or on social media published, I was so thrilled. I felt like it was a major hurdle in my progress toward what? I don't know. But I it was necessary. Getting a book, I think, made me feel as though, no, now I have evidence. I have concrete evidence of my work in the world and of what I love and what I do. So there was that. And it's something to keep in your hand. You know how people say, I needed something in my hand, as, you know, people who smoke or whatever. I never smoked. But you want something in your hand when you go to a poetry conference that, yeah, I've got one too.
It's a physicality.
Know. It's physical. It's an object out there.
And it represents years of work, and other people have read it, edited it, liked it, you know, supported it.
You can share it.
Yes. How about for you, Susan?
I love that answer. I was at a panel discussion about academic publishing at Carleton once, and one of the people I really admire said, you need to publish because it makes you part of the conversation. Mm. And I have never forgotten that phrase, because it was sort of... it was as if the reminder was, you can't just sit on the lines and be a consumer or an observer. You've got to somehow participate. And as teachers, we want our classes to participate. You know, we want people to write poems down and memorize them and, like, think about it. So I think for me, that's part of it. It's like I really participated. And every now and then I'll get an email from someone I don't know who read the book. And just it blows me away that there's a reader who didn't know me, didn't know to look for this, and found it and was moved by something. So that's really special.
Oh, that's incredible. Two incredible poets. We're very lucky in Northfield to have so many wonderful poets, and these poets I know you're going to adore. And so I hope you'll join us at that event at Content on the 15th at 7 p.m. Folks, this is Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thank you so much for joining me and for celebrating poetry this National Poetry Month. I hope you always find time for your imagination and try to write a poem or read a poem this week. It's worth it.
You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a vibrant cultural and artistic gathering spot in historic downtown Faribault. The Paradise is committed to offering high-quality visual and performing art opportunities for Faribault and our region.
Regular events spotlight some of the best artists and musicians in our area and throughout Minnesota and the Upper Midwest. Our beautifully restored facility includes art galleries, classrooms, clay and textile labs, a gift shop and rehearsal spaces, in addition to a 300-seat auditorium. Visit ParadiseCenterForTheArts.org for a full schedule of events or call our box office at 507-332-7372.
Do you have an old junk or car in the